This is Pure Decking for Thursday, February the 22nd, 2014. This is the show about stuff that interests me, like descending into a police state, information security, and watching just how crazy the cat gets when there's lots of birds outside. I'm Morps, and tonight I've got an expert cat watcher, Madman. An expert at being watched by cats, RU486.
Thank you, sir.
And a man who won't claim to be an expert at anything for legal reasons. Hey, Sard.
You have to talk to my lawyer first before you acknowledge my presence.
As I'll be representing Sard tonight, Sard says hello.
Nice.
Thank you.
Very nice.
You must relay all questions tonight through my lawyer to be, if you want to comment for me.
So, I'm drinking my last Dogfish Head Chicory Stout tonight. If anybody has anything interesting they're drinking they want to throw out, now's the time.
Sam Adams Cold Snap.
Oh, nice.
Water. I'm adventurous.
Well, it is Australia. God knows what's in that water. Probably poisoned. Australia. No, even the water's venomous.
I've got Honeycrisp apple wheat.
Nice. Very nice. A little bit of station news. We're going to be, I'm going to be doing some stream work this weekend, so it'll be up and down, but hopefully it'll get a hell of a lot more stable after that. And we're kind of hoping the current stream makes it through the night because we figured out it's made it a week without falling over and burning down, sinking into the swamp. So, you know, here's hoping. It'd suck if it died on us in the middle of the show tonight. So I actually have a backup recorder growing locally just in case it does. But I know Sard's doing some work for us on the back end as well. So I'm sure we'll figure it out. We'll get it working.
So. Yep.
Anyways, so moving right into it here. I actually had two really good candidates for the, what we really wanted to dive into tonight, but I've been bitching about ISPs for like a month now, so I figured we'd stick on that. In case anybody wasn't paying attention, it has begun. Netflix has made a deal with Comcast. They are literally paying Comcast it's to carry their content, but it's not in the way you might think. A couple of different stories here that I've got to pull from. The short version, I guess to summarize it, Netflix is going to be paying Comcast to carry their content. Now, that doesn't mean that Comcast was blocking Netflix, which was, you know, of course, the great fear of net neutrality. They just weren't doing a very good job of talking to Netflix's current ISP, which is Cogent, I believe. And so you could argue that Comcast wasn't doing a fantastic job of managing their network links and their peering agreements, but they also refused to make it any better unless somebody paid them to do it. And so what Netflix has done is they've designed these servers that they were going to put in various ISPs' data centers, saying, look, you run our servers, all you got to do is put the box on your network and it'll save you a ton of bandwidth. Going back to our services, especially for most of Netflix is static content. It's not like it's got to keep it in sync with anything. It just does a call back to the Netflix servers to make sure, you know, you've paid for it, and then it uses the local server. Well, Comcast refused to do that unless Netflix paid them. So Netflix is paying them. So the story from MarketWatch here, Netflix Inc. has agreed to pay Comcast Corp. to ensure Netflix movies and television shows stream smoothly on Comcast customers, a landmark pact that could set a precedent for Netflix's dealings with other broadband providers, people familiar with the matter said. In exchange for payment, Netflix will get direct access to Comcast's broadband network. In a statement confirming the broad outlines of the deal, The companies on Sunday said the agreement would provide Comcast's U.S. broadband customers with a high-quality Netflix video experience for years to come. For the past year, the online video giant, which has more than 30 million paid subscribers in the U.S., has been in a standoff with all the major broadband providers, including Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, and Time Warner. Netflix wanted to connect its specialized servers free of charge to the provider's networks, arguing that such a link would improve streaming quality for its customers. They leave out of the story that it would also save the ISPs a crap ton of bandwidth in the peering agreements. That's why they wanted to do it. That's why they wanted to the ISPs to let them do it without charging them. And because it's not so much that they weren't charging, it's just that it would also save them a bunch of money. But they wouldn't do it. So where was I? Netflix has won such agreements from smaller broadband providers in the U.S., including Cablevision, as well as other operators overseas. But major U.S. providers, including Comcast, wanted to be paid for the connections because of the heavy load of traffic Netflix sends to their networks. In the wake of its deal with Comcast, Netflix is likely to compensate the other big providers, said a person familiar with the situation. Netflix has historically routed its streaming content to broadband providers to a number of internet middlemen, but since mid-2012, the company has been trying to reduce what it pays these middlemen by getting broadband companies to hook directly to its new video distribution network without paying them fees for carrying its traffic. So it's not quite as bad as everybody thought it would be with the whole net neutrality thing going away. But it's still not fantastic, because what you've got is you now have a precedent set that the ISPs don't have to deal with these congested links and won't pay for upgrading the infrastructure, getting a better link to serve their customers. They will wait until somebody else makes a deal with them to do it.
That's interesting, because I was under the impression that they weren't doing that already. I mean, who was the exec or whatever that said, oh, people don't want faster speeds, they don't want Google Fiber or whatever?
I think that was the Verizon guy.
They haven't wanted to upgrade their infrastructure to benefit the customer and give us more bandwidth and all that for years.
No, but the thing is, what... as opposed to just not wanting to do it, eventually customer demand would force them to do it. Be like, well, why does my Netflix, I'm trying to use Netflix on Comcast and it sucks, but when I use this DSL, which is half the speed, it's fantastic. What the fuck,
right.
And they don't, of course, that would eventually force Comcast to fix the problem. And Netflix, of course, didn't want to deal with crappy service in the meantime. So as opposed to waiting on their customers to demand and Comcast do something about it on their end, Netflix is paying them up front. So that sets the precedent, not just for Netflix, but for any large enough service, that if you're stuck behind a congested connection, unless you pay the ISP, they're not going to fix it.
But isn't there the other side of this where... that was the first time I had heard about them wanting to put the caching or, the proxy servers in there.
Right. Nobody talks about that part, do they? They all just talk, oh, God, Netflix paid Comcast.
Because that makes sense. You're putting servers on their network, probably in their location, close to their backplane or core routers and stuff like that. I mean, I could understand why they're paying them for that.
Well, I mean, sure, I can see the small operation cost or whatever, but everybody leaves out the bit about the Netflix servers, because they like the slug line of, oh God, Netflix is playing Comcast not to throttle them.
Yeah,
and that's not what happened.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I was just gonna say. It doesn't sound like that's what's actually happened, because that's what everyone has been saying.
What the thing is. It's this particular deal is not that egregious. It's really not. It's just Netflix is paying for rack space on Comcast's backbone, and Comcast is wanting them to pay for the bandwidth they're going to use on Comcast's network. And I can certainly see Netflix's argument that, between your peering agreements, we're going to save you so much bank that you should let us do this for free. Because all this traffic never has to leave the Comcast network. It doesn't have to go out across, out across however many ISPs to hit Cogent. you know, actually hitting the backbone. And if you, Sarge, you know how most peering agreements work. I mean, it's a bandwidth trade-off. They, you know, they pay each other nominal fees, or sometimes they don't even bother with that. But a lot of times these peering agreements, you know, if they've swapped an even amount of data, of course, they just do a write-off. But if one side has done significantly more than the other, of course, they have to pay. They pay for the difference. So apparently Netflix has been costing the ISPs a lot in these peering agreements.
Right.
So, of course, the great fear was always that Comcast would block or at least severely limit access to Netflix unless Netflix paid.
Yeah.
And they weren't doing that. They just weren't managing their congested links and router tables very well. So, and from a network management standpoint, that may not have been a winning battle. There may not have been a way to route that much traffic across whatever links they have.
Right. Well, isn't Netflix traffic supposed to be like some ungodly amount of like the overall traffic going across the world right now? Isn't it something like 30-40% or something?
Oh, I thought it was more than that.
Or more than that? I mean, I guess that makes sense. I don't know. This kind of makes me irritated now because everyone's been crying wolf and saying, "Oh my God, they're paying them." You know, they're paying so they, you know, don't throttle them or whatever. And it doesn't sound like it's that at all.
Okay, here's where I saw it. It was a CNET story, and they're saying that Netflix is about a third of their traffic normally, downstream traffic. This is worldwide. This is internet, and YouTube is behind them at like 18% of, you know, down. But it's also it jumps up during peak hours to something more like 50%.
Okay,
but it's not sustained. It's only peak.
I mean, it's probably a kind of a greedy business move to make them pay to put their caching servers on their backbone, so they don't actually have to leave their network. But I mean,
the deal itself is not nearly as bad as it's been made out to be.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
My concern is the precedent this sets. So, just as an example here from The Verge, Verizon CEO wasted no time in announcing that the company expected to strike a similar bargain on CNBC February the 24th. Verizon's chief, Lowell McAdams, revealed that Netflix and Verizon have been in talks for almost a year now, and that he expects to finalize a deal soon. If you see someone coming in with a lot of load on the internet with video, you've got to get that in an efficient place. So making a connection far out on the network is a good thing, and frankly, paying for it, said McAdams. To me, this shows you don't necessarily need a lot of regulation in a dynamic market here, but doing these commercial deals would get good investments and good return for both parties. Well, I kind of agree with him on that front, that I don't want to see a lot of regulation, because then you end up with rules that don't work for anybody. But, you know, there's Verizon right there saying, oh, Comcast got their payoff, where's ours? So, I mean, he's right there saying it. And you know every other major ISP is thinking it too. It's like, well, they got their payoff, where's ours? And the precedent this sets could get bad, because right now it's Netflix trying to deal with a bandwidth issue, right? But what happens, let's say, you know, a couple years down the line, you know, YouTube is right there behind Netflix as far as traffic goes, percentage-wise. So, you know, Google, you're moving a lot of data off the network there, and you really got to look at this caching system that Netflix has set up, because it'd be a shame if we had to start, you know, putting some rate limits in place to manage our network.
Right, but I mean, didn't they kind of be expecting that? Because like I said, they're such a large chunk of the bandwidth that they're pushing through.
Right, but I'm saying that they might artificially make it worse to try to encourage these kind of deals, because they're going to come, you know, the thing is, does it bother me that much that Netflix is going to be playing Comcast? No, not really. Unless my Netflix bill goes up significantly.
And well, depending on how much they have to pay out to all the other ISPs,
it might.
Their cost gets passed down. They're there to make a profit.
So ultimately, I mean, if you think about it, if the ISPs are forcing a service you pay for to pay them more, well, or to pay them in the first place, but pay them more than, you know, what their normal operating cost is, that means your price is going up. So ultimately, that price increase that you pay is going back to the ISPs. It's just kind of a backdoor way of doing it. And of course, you have the option of not using that service and not paying it, but still.
Well, if there's not any other competitors in that market, it's either do you have the internet or do you not have the internet?
Yeah.
I will concede it's still a choice. It's just a crappy one, seeing how the reason I have the choice of having the internet or not having the internet is a law saying no one else can start an ISP around here.
Right. And that's ultimately my real concern, right? ISPs now have no incentive to manage their network properly, but they have a business reason to keep popular services running slower. And this wouldn't even be an issue, except there's no competition in the ISP space. There's like five for the United States, big ones.
Right.
That's it. And so if all five of those are going to cut deals, I mean, yeah, go ahead, are you?
Do you think that those five are going to allow a new player into the market?
They couldn't stop them if the laws allowed for them to enter. Right now, the reason that Time Warner has a monopoly in my area isn't that there aren't other people wanting to be in this area. It's that it's illegal for anyone else to be in this area.
That's what I said. We've spoken about it before, so I can't see the problem ever going away. It's only going to get worse. More expensive.
Yeah, you're right. Not unless you get... It's a question of infrastructure, right? So the only way to get some kind of a competitor would be to have a completely different technology than the copper cable line coming into your house or the copper telephone line coming into your house. You know, you'd need some kind of a... And fiber, they've decided, is pretty much a municipality, so that falls under a lot of these agreements. So I know Google was trying to come in with their Google Fiber service, and that's how they were getting around some of these agreements, is they were arguing that fiber wasn't covered under these agreements, and almost immediately that's when you started seeing a lot of these ISPs going to... You know, telephone company, cable companies going up to their city governments and saying, look, you've got to amend the law to include fiber because we're supposed to provide that. And that, you know, we kind of touched on that before, but that's going on. So you need almost a completely different kind of delivery mechanism that doesn't run afoul of these local monopolies.
No, you just get rid of the laws that allow the local monopolies to exist.
Well, that would be fantastic, but I'm trying to think in things that could actually happen because there's so much money going into politics, it's really hard to, you know, get these entrenched companies to give up these agreements. So, I mean, maybe a wireless connection or that dumbass thing from space, which would never work in a million years. Whatever that thing was. Did anybody else see that? We were talking about it. That project of providing free internet from satellites in space, microsatellites in space.
Yeah, that was stupid.
Well, my only problem with that was they were saying they were going to use Wi-Fi, and it was to get around censorship and everything else. And I was just trying to figure out how. There is no way Wi-Fi gets that distance.
Wow.
I mean, the signal degrades a little too quick. I mean, hell, I got problems getting Wi-Fi in parts of my house. I don't know how I'd get it from space.
You'll be fine.
What we're going to do is we're going to strap a big-ass antenna on it.
Yeah, that'd be about it, wouldn't it?
Don't worry about the cancer clusters. At least you've got good internet.
If you get cold, go stand in front of it. It'll warm you right up.
Yeah. Ah! And nice. That was the last time Timmy ever shoveled snow on his driveway.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I mean, having read it, like I said, it's not really as egregious as it's made out to be in the, you know, link bait headlines. But it's still setting a nasty precedent that if you're a big enough service provider, they can essentially hold you hostage till you make some kind of a deal with them. So, I don't know. I mean, am I reading too much into this here?
Oh, I don't think so.
No, I mean, that's pretty much, I think, the general consensus has been. Like I said, I don't know. I guess if it forces them to upgrade their network and actually get fiber to more people's houses and stuff like that, that cost is going to come down the line to the rest of us, but they aren't going to do it now anyways, so... I don't know. Does that make sense, I guess, or...
What Netflix is doing isn't helping with the forcing them to run fiber. I'm cool with paying my provider more money if they're improving their infrastructure, but what they're doing is trying to charge someone else more money and still not fixing the problem.
Right, exactly. They're just coming at it from a different angle, and they run the network, and there's obviously a cost associated with that. I'm not saying that ISPs don't deserve to get paid for the service they provide. I'm just not caring for this tactic of forcing individual internet companies to cut deals with every ISP individually. You know what I mean?
Well,
I don't know how you get it. Yeah.
I think it goes against the deal they originally had with Netflix. Netflix had a deal that you'll provide network access to our site, we will pay X amount of dollars.
True.
So any company that's artificially slowing down the network connection for them, either through bad routing or whatever, that's breaching their contract and fucking not only Netflix over, but me over as a consumer of both Netflix and ISPs.
Yeah, so I mean, I don't know. Well, I know what the fix is. I'd love to see, the fix is competition among ISPs, force them to actually do a good job. But I don't know how we get there from where we are right now, truthfully.
The only way to do it is deregulation, which you've already said is going to be hard to do. You'd have to get enough people informed about the problem and pushing for a solution. I don't think that's going to happen.
Right, so I'm trying to think of a solution that's actually possible.
There isn't. If you go with the wireless route, you have the same problem, except now instead of local governments, you have to deal with the FCC, which have put limits on how many wireless providers there can be in an area. You can't just start up a cell phone company or a data transfer company over the airwaves, because there are a limited number of licenses in each area for that particular product. So to go wireless like you suggested earlier, you would still have the problem of changing the laws to allow for competition. So it's which donkey do you want to rape? The ISPs or the cell phone providers? But you'll have to fight somebody.
What about mesh nets? Weren't that one that supposed to be a thing for a while there? You know, everybody was going to set up a hack router in their house, and they'd make a big-ass mesh net, and that would replace the internet. Wasn't that supposed to be a thing?
Yeah, dark nets, but you gotta get that info out, how to do it, and get more people involved in order for that to be successful.
Well, I mean, you gotta chain areas together, too, somehow, and sometimes there's not enough, like, get it out to somebody on a farm or something. I don't know how that would work, so...
Net between cities?
Yeah, that'd be a good point, too. How would you get it? You'd still have to have somebody who had an internet connection somewhere to make the thing work. So, anyways, let's go ahead and move on to the current events here. First one up is from Ars Technica. As of late Monday evening, the embattled Bitcoin site Mt. Gox appears to have pulled the plug entirely in the wake of sustained DDoS attacks and the transaction malleability problem that has plagued other websites. The site is gone, and the company's Twitter account appears to have been completely erased. Our request to Mt. Gox for comment was not immediately returned. Bitcoin's trading price has been steadily declining since the beginning of 2014, and as of this writing, it's around 470 and falling. Now I'm kind of curious what it's up to. So I'm going to take just a quick second and check here. Oops.
It was around still 500 or 600.
It was 500 last time I looked.
Preve has it pegged at 571 at the moment. So it's starting to come back up.
Yeah.
So
half of its value since the beginning of the year.
Yeah. While Mt. Gox itself was unavailable, other Bitcoin sites joined together on Monday evening to make a joint statement to the Bitcoin community regarding Mt. Gox. They write, "This tragic violation of the trust of users of Mt. Gox was the result of one company's actions and does not reflect the resilience or value of Bitcoin and the digital currency industry. There are hundreds of trustworthy and responsible companies involved in Bitcoin. These companies will continue to build the future of money by making Bitcoin more secure and easy to use for consumers and merchants. As with any new industry, there are certainly bad actors that need to be weeded out, and this is what we are seeing today." Meanwhile, a crisis strategy draft slide deck that appeared to have come from Mt. Gox began to circulate on Twitter. It outlines a plan to shut down Mt. Gox for 1 month with a rebranded landing page to be completed by the morning of February 25th, Japan time. However, this deadline has passed already. The undated document with the authenticity of which could not be verified, states that the Tokyo-based company lost over 744,000 bitcoins, worth around $350 million, in a malleability-related theft that went on for years. Wait, were they not watching the books? That if it went on for years?
Is this that supposed exploit that Bitcoin has had since its inception? That everyone knew about already, and
yeah, kind of.
From what I understand, isn't really a problem.
So,
why is Mt. Gox the only one that's crying wolf over this?
Because they stole everyone's money, and they need a scapegoat.
Yeah, they need a scapegoat. Okay.
Well, Madman got it out before I did. That's exactly what I think is going on too.
Let's go with allegedly, because this is a lot of money. And this could end up in court. So allegedly stole.
Well, yeah. Let's face it.
Allegedly,
it's a cryptocurrency, though. It's not. It's not a regulated money amount or whatever, you know.
But they were also holding cash, so I don't know. Regardless of malleability and regulatory issues, Mt. Gox's main problems are massive robbery and poor Bitcoin accounting, the document states. However, the business as an exchange is highly profitable and healthy when run properly. The document refers to a rebranding as Gox under a new CEO and a new executives. And indeed, Gox.com, who is record, show that it was recently sold to Mark Karples. Am I saying that right? Current CEO of Mt. Gox. Karples also did not respond to ours request for comment. Update: Mt. Gox has updated its homepage with the following message after publication. Dear Mt. Gox customers, in the event of recent news reports and potential repercussions on Mt. Gox operations in the market, a decision was taken to close all transactions for the time being in order to protect the site and our users. We'll be closely monitoring the situation and react accordingly. Best regards, Mt. Gox team. You know, so if you have anything in Mt. Gox, it's gone because they have shut the site down.
We're protecting our users by taking their money and running the fuck away.
Oh, well, that's what they're doing.
Yeah.
And actually, all this Mt. Gox hoopla was, if it weren't for the Netflix Comcast thing, which I'm a little bit more interested in than the Bitcoin stuff, truthfully, I would have done Mt. Gox as the discussion topic, because that's, as far as Bitcoin is concerned, that's a big deal. I don't know why Mt. Gox was so trusted. I mean, they have had a horrible reputation from the top.
Right. Well, they were
like
the original.
One of the biggest or the biggest Bitcoin exchange.
Right. And everyone had talked about it. Everyone looked at them for their exchange rate and just based a lot of it off of them. And they went and got greedy and either screwed up majorly or, like we all think, took the money and ran.
Well, it may not be the company that took the money and ran. It may be somebody who worked for them that did it. But I mean, if this has been going on for years, I mean, I'm not an accountant, but you're telling me nobody looked at the totals and said, the ledger says we should have this, but the accounts actually have this? Nobody did that comparison?
I'm not sure how many Bitcoin exchanges have good transparency or good accounting practices. That's one downside to cryptocurrencies. They're not generally being ran by bankers or accountants. They're being ran by idealists, and they shouldn't run stuff.
Well, technically, they were trying to get away from bankers and accountants, I think, with a lot of Bitcoin.
Right.
Or at least bankers, maybe not accountants. But I just
they
still that
do
seems
a great
like something.
Job. It's the governments that fuck up the banking sector.
It just seems like something somebody would have checked and went, huh?
This is weird.
Yeah, it's like the accounts don't line up. That seems like, you know, should we be concerned about that? Oh, nah. somebody who works for them or the company itself, or, you know, grabbed the money and ran.
Right.
Because, I mean, $350 million in a poorly regulated, misunderstood industry that, honestly, not a lot of people would notice. Can't tell me somebody didn't look at that and try to just... Go ahead, Batman.
I was going to go in an industry that has probably never been audited or even knows what an audit is.
Yeah, you're going to tell me somebody didn't take a look at that and say, huh, there's a good chance I'm going to get away with this and not grab it and run?
I say if we ever find the guy, his name's going to go the way of Ponzi. This scheme is going to be named after him.
I believe there is the term getting goxed.
The first time I heard that today, I think it's
great.
Yeah,
me too.
I'm fairly certain I've heard that one before, though.
Thanks. Let's check Urban Dictionary. I'm on the interwebs.
That's kind of what I'm doing, too, at the moment. Urban Dictionary, goxed. Being effectively fooled and or trolled repeatedly, derived from the temporary closure of the Bitcoin exchange Mt. Gox in June 2011, and then repeated delays in reopening for trading. So, yeah, this happened in 2011. And when Mt. Gox came back online, people started using it again.
Fool me once, shame on you. Fool me twice, I'm a moron.
Yeah.
Isn't that the point, though, of reputation? The whole point of Bitcoin is a truly free market. Reputation regulates free market, not...
The average individual has the memory span of a fucking goldfish. That the simple reason is, just take a look at Congress.
But even a goldfish eventually learns not to swim into the damn glass.
No, they just die. Never truly learn. They bang their little bubbly heads all day. And they die. It's not the bowl's fault. It's the fish's fault.
All right. Well.
People just have no memories of this stuff, Morps.
This is the... You can grab any cell phone and Google it and find this shit.
People are just too damn trusting, and they don't have any memories. And if you told them, well, the security's been fixed, I don't care. You and me, I don't care. I'm not trusting them ever again. Most people are like, yeah, okay.
You know, honestly, this is honest truth. Back when Bitcoin was still up and coming, I seriously looked at getting into it. And of the exchanges I looked at, Mt. Gox included, not a one of them I felt comfortable giving financial information to.
Yeah.
Which is why I never made any major, you know, I seriously wanted to get into Bitcoin a lot sooner than I did. And I saw no way into it outside of miners. And I don't want to give these people my money because I'm afraid my credit card's going to be sold to somebody who doesn't speak English and I will have to close out my bank accounts.
Are you okay with selling it to people that do speak English?
Or how about English? Can they speak English?
Okay, well, yeah. You know what I meant.
I was going to say, Madman, we need to have a chat later.
Yeah. Got a bridge to sell you.
Yeah, I mean, you know damn well what I meant. But, I honestly thought that my card would be stolen if I, you know, punched any information in these guys. And, you know, of course, you go get a temporary credit card or something like that. And it's like, that's a lot of hassle for...
I would like to point out, the market has seen the same thing. Bitcoin is a niche. Very few people use it. That's the
true.
Market responded to it not being trustworthy.
Yeah. That's true. That is true.
Well, that's one thing I've always thought about. I mean, with it being a niche and so few people, and now... Because of things like Mt. Gox shutting down and all that, it seems to me like it's getting demonized a lot more. What do you guys think? Like, long term, is it going to be around? You know,
I don't know
from
that,
now?
Bitcoin is going to be around, but I think derivatives of it will be around for various purposes. I don't see it being a replacement for general currency, but I do see it being a specialty kind of thing.
Do you think it's going to become, you know, like, in my eyes, I keep seeing it in different places. In some places, it really is almost becoming demonized, like, with the word hacker, you know? If you're a hacker, you're an evil person that breaks and steals credit card numbers, breaks into banks and stuff like that. People are saying, oh, you know, you use Bitcoin, you know, are you buying drugs on the internet? Are you hiring a hitman? Like, seems like it's...
That's kind of what I mean, though, is that Bitcoins and cryptocurrencies derived from Bitcoin will be used in niche, kind of what you'd call a sub-market, you know, where you want to have several services using the same, you know, internet money. I don't know if there's a better term
for it. And that's kind of how it is now, but what I'm wondering is, like I said, like 15 years from now, is that market going to have grown from what it is today, or will it have gotten smaller?
I imagine there'll be a lot more of them. The individual markets won't be that big, but there'll be a lot more of them. Then you'll have one that uses Litecoin, one that uses Bitcoins, one that uses Dogecoin. I don't know.
Here are the problems with them breaking out. One, they're a microcurrency. And the downside to being that is they're really, really easy for someone to manipulate. If one of the Koch brothers, for example, not saying that they would, but if they decided to fuck over Bitcoin... They go in, buy a ton of them, and just currency manipulate the hell out of it.
Well, that's been going on with Bitcoin anyways.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's one reason it can be done is it's a microcurrency. The other issue with Bitcoin is it's a deflationary currency. That means the longer you hold on to it, the more valuable it is. So it's really, really hard to get anyone to spend it. Because, like I've pointed out in another argument we've had before, anyone who bought one of the first things you could buy with Bitcoin, which was alpaca hair socks, I think it's hilarious that was one of the first things you could buy. But they spent what was the equivalent in Bitcoin then of like $4 or $5 for socks. Had they waited until now, well, waited until the height of Bitcoin, the amount of Bitcoins they spent on those socks would have been worth millions. So... people don't spend them, they hang on to them, which makes it really, really hard for any of these types of currencies to take off. No one wants to spend them as currency.
Yeah.
And those two reasons will make it very, very, very hard for them to break out just from a sheer money standpoint. And then there's the trustworthiness standpoint. The reason the world's big currencies are big is I believe they'll be worth something tomorrow, and so do millions and millions of other people. The trust in cryptocurrency isn't there widespread enough.
Go ahead, Sard.
I agree with what you just said, man, but what makes you think why... like you said, you know, Bitcoins aren't at their peak right now. You know, they peaked at, what, like $1,600 or whatever number it was, and they're back down to $500-$600. Seeing that, what would make me think that in 15 years from now it's going to be worth even more?
It's the way it's run, it's like a commodity. Commodities aren't, they're large things. You don't buy things in houses, you know?
The reason they're going to keep gaining in price, there's a set number of Bitcoins.
And they're losing. There's a problem with Bitcoin in that there's no way to recover lost coins. Now, they did that as a security issue, but like I've got, what, like 0.3 Bitcoin floating around in a wallet somewhere. And since I had last rebuilt my machine, I haven't bothered to reinstall my Bitcoin wallet and import my keys and all that good stuff. So whereas I can go back in and get it at any time, kind of from a technical sense, the Bitcoins I was kind of holding on to from my mining experiment are lost. There's not really any way to recover them unless I reinstall my wallet and pull them back out. But that happens a lot. There were people going through the blockchain and figuring out that there were tons of inactive wallets, you know, sitting on like the 50 Bitcoins back from when the thing started, where people mined it, but lost interest and then just never came back to it. And, you know, they've lost their crypto key or whatever. And not to mention the ones seized, you know, by the government from the Silk Road shutdown, and you know, now Mt. Gox has lost a ton of them. You think about it, there's an ever dwindling supply of the damn things. Even with mining going on, there's just not that many new ones being made. You know, they're going to keep going up just because Bitcoin will hit that finite end supply number, and there will be a lot fewer Bitcoins floating around than the amount that have been mined, just from loss.
And that
what about?
Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask what about Doggy Coin or Dogecoin, whatever you want to call it, where it has an infinite supply. I mean, it halves all the way up to 600,000 blocks. And then after that, it doesn't have any more, but blocks are worth 10,000 coins each, and it's that way forever.
God, I don't know. Dog coins set up by 4chan. Who knows what that thing's going to do? Well, I mean,
for all the good they move, you might as well stick them up your ass.
What are they worth right now, anyways?
I'll look it up.
No, I'm genuinely curious because I've not been following Dogecoin. Mainly because those memes like piss me off.
Well, okay, 1,000 Dogecoin is $1.14 in US dollars.
And how many do you get for solving a block?
Right now it's 50,000 or up to 500,000. It's a random amount between 1 and 500,000.
But there's not a finite number of them that they can expand forever?
Yeah, they expand forever.
In the long run, they'll be worth nothing. Because there'll be so many of them, nobody will have them.
It would be a similar issue to what actual currencies have. It goes into trusting whoever's running the currency. Because it might not be overly inflating itself. I mean, the US dollar, for all I bitch about it, which it needs to be bitched about, it's stable, and it's literally a fictitious currency, and there could be a billion of them, or there could be two of them.
Right, and that's why we joke, if they need more money, they just go print it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, with that, as far as cryptocurrencies, you're going to have all the trust issues of any other cryptocurrency, and then the issue of, do you trust the currency itself as having innate value? One thing Bitcoin was going for is a claim of innate value because of its scarcity.
Okay.
Which I'll go with is false anyway, because no currency has innate value.
Right, because they're all virtual type thing. That's kind of the idea behind 42 coin is another cryptocurrency, and there's only 42 coins that can be mined in the entire blockchain, and that's why they're worth like $98,000 a piece or something the last time I looked. Yeah, because there's only 42 of them. So it's like, I don't know. That's what I'm trying to figure out. I've been mining now for probably 4 months or so. I like it. It's fun to get into and mess with and you know, mine and all that. But I'm just wondering, as far as long term, in 15 years, am I really going to give a shit or not?
You're not. It's going to be a hobby unless a country picks it up. I see the technology is having value because I could see a country moving to this is a way of deriving money.
Just they control the mining and dole it out as opposed to...
And I think that has merit and is a good idea. I don't think it's going to pick up until either a country or a large enough segment of the population does it, and I don't think the population is going to do it on their own. That's why I say a country has to adopt it.
It'd be a good way of having... like food stamps and stuff like that, making you work for it.
I wouldn't go with mining. I just saw it as like a constraint on Federal Reserve banking.
Yeah, okay.
Because one problem with any currency isn't it's trustworthy much as well, it is with its trustfulness. The banks can manipulate it like mad, and I like some idea of constraint. So if there is a limited amount of dollars per block, yeah, there might be an infinite number of blocks, but it slows what the rate of inflation can be to a maximum amount.
Yeah.
And it enforces that. Right now, the U.S. Fed's mandated with keeping inflation around like 2 or 3%. The way they've done that is they've redefined what inflation is. So
beautiful.
They haven't been going with their mandate ever, but no one holds them to it because they just redefine what the word is that's in their mandate. If you have a cryptocurrency behind it, forcing them to keep inflation at a certain level, the technology would work, and since a government's backing it, there would be value and enough people in it that it would take off. So I like the technology, I just don't think it's going to ever take off privately.
All right, let's see. Next story up, this one's from torrentfreak.com. Music Collecting Society and anti-piracy group GEMA has scored a big victory in its long-running battle with Google-owned YouTube. A court has ordered the video giant to remove blocking messages, which claims GEMA is to blame for thousands of videos being unavailable in Germany on copyright grounds. Simply searching for the terms unavailable in Germany reveals the scale of the problem. Thousands of complaints from the man on the street right up to record label bosses show that the licensing dispute with the collecting society anti-piracy group GEMA has hit every corner. It is a complex battle with a simple disagreement at its core. In 2007, the entities reached a licensing agreement for YouTube to use works from GEMA's extensive repertoire. 2 years later, negotiations to extend that deal broke down when GEMA's long-term demand of around 0.12 euros per stream was rejected by Google. That's expensive, 0.12 euros per stream. That's not per video. That's for every time that video is played.
And that doesn't even have to be their content, does it? It's every time a video on Google is played.
Basically.
They couldn't have... Could they afford that? Could anyone afford that?
Anybody can afford that. In May of 2010, GEMA sued to have YouTube block certain titles so that they could not be viewed locally. In April of 2012, after much legal wrangling, the regional court of Hamburg ruled that YouTube could be held liable for the infringing videos and must therefore take measures to render content unavailable in Germany. And therein lies the problem. YouTube is a constant source of frustration for German users thanks to the blocking of thousands of videos as a result of the GEMA dispute. When local users try to access popular videos being enjoyed by their fellow internet users, GEMA claims that YouTube overblocks unnecessarily, they are greeted with a message that informs them that they should blame GEMA, not YouTube, for the inconvenience.
GEMA is the person to blame, or entity to blame.
Right, but just understand what they're complaining about here. They're complaining about the fact that YouTube puts up a message saying they have blocked this video in your country based on a copyright dispute with GEMA.
They're telling the truth.
And GEMA is pissed about this. Time and again, users are informed that videos are blocked due to GEMA not granting the necessary music rights. As a result, GEMA has become very, very unpopular. Trying to remedy the situation, GEMA applied for an injunction to force YouTube to change the messages, claiming that they misrepresent the situation and damage GEMA's reputation. YouTube alone is responsible for blocking the videos, claiming otherwise is simply false, GEMA argued. You're making them block it. That's hilarious.
What a bunch of assholes. Oh, they're blocking it, but we're telling them to do it, but it's not us doing it. So
right.
They're the assholes, right.
It gets better because they won. Yesterday, the District Court of Munich agreed with the music group and issued an injunction to force YouTube to comply, stating that the notice... denigrate. Okay, brain function. I've been drinking. Forced YouTube to comply, stating that the notices denigrate GEMA with a totally distorted representation of the legal dispute between the parties. Changing the message to state that videos are not available due to a lack of licensing agreement between YouTube and GEMA would be more appropriate, the court said. They're arguing over the language of the block message. For almost 3 years, YouTube has misled the public with these blocking messages. And I just imagine somebody from Monty Python reading this thing, really. YouTube has misled the public with these blocking messages and unlawfully influenced public opinion at the expense of GEMA. GEMA CEO Dr. Harald Hecker. Really? Hecker? Harald Hecker?
It might not be as funny in Germany.
Okay. Said in a statement. The decision... sends an important and positive signal. It's not GEMA preventing the enjoyment of music on the internet. It seeks merely to license YouTube like all other music portals. Our concern is that the artists participate in the economic exploitation of their works and can earn a livelihood in the future. YouTube's parent company Google said it was studying studying the decision. We need to examine the reasons for the judgment before we can make a decision about what to do next, the spokesperson said. Once the judgment of the district court in Munich is made final, YouTube faces fines of up to, good God, 250,000 euros per breach. And depending on how they define breach, that could be per video or per the time that message is displayed.
So, how, you guys help me out here. Like, I don't understand how does that German court have any say over YouTube? They're a U.S. based company. I assume most of their main servers, headquarters, are all in the U.S. Why can't they just tell them to shove it up their ass? You don't have any jurisdiction over us.
I'm assuming they've got a local YouTube or local German site, and Google is technically a multinational now because they do have several international sites.
Okay, so they must have some sort of headquarters or whatever there.
Right, but they also don't want to just be flat blocked in a country, so I'm sure that they're trying to comply with local laws. And a lot of governments will say that because their content is viewable locally, that they therefore have to comply with local law.
But
I think that's actually
it's
how
viewable
the U.S.
over anywhere on the internet.
Yeah,
how can they
well,
say...
laws are not written with the internet in mind very often, so they're able to apply things in weird ways. It's sort of like that kid from England who set up a ninja video or whatever it was and was extradited to the U.S. for the crimes he committed in the U.S. by setting up a website in Britain.
What the fuck?
Yeah. You don't remember that one?
I vaguely remember it, yeah.
That one still stands out in my mind as a great what the fuck moment.
Yeah.
It's like he had never left Britain. And they extradited him to the States because he set up a website that was hosted in Britain. So, it's weird. I'm not exactly sure how that works, but I mean, you're kind of right. You'd think that they're an American company that could tell a German court to get stuffed, but
yeah.
You want to sell your product in Germany, you apply by Germany's laws.
Yeah, I guess.
Well, get
out. Guess.
But Google's just an internet company anymore. You have to think of that. They have to look at all their business relations and
that's
interests.
True. That's true.
Okay. I guess. It just, like I said, it's connected to the internet. Anyone connected to the internet can get to it. They don't have to have a base of operations in Germany or whatever. I mean,
you're basing that on the knowledge today. In 10 years' time, dude, it mightn't be just because you're on the internet that you can get to each country. Or each country's content.
So.
And Google's looking at it as, we also want to sell smartphones in Germany.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I guess that makes more sense as to why they would have a...
Well...
Or headquarters there or whatever.
No company of significant size that does business all around the world the way Google does is going to tell a first world nation to get bent.
Don't negotiate it. No money or swap hands. It'll be great.
Well, that's probably true. But let's see. Next story up. Okay, this one is fun, but it's very poorly written. So I'm going to try to translate it as I read it. It's from tech.eu. When scrappy little startups succeed in putting a dent in multi-billion-dollar businesses, entrenched corporations that are under attack tend to get very nervous. Not everybody embraces change. Inevitably, some of them will resort to shady tactics to hinder, counter, or completely stop challengers from posing a threat to their core business. This morning, a Hacker News article led the author of this blog post to another hog post, or another blog post, in which Hamburg, Germany-based Michael Bucher exposes a nasty trick and smear campaign from 1&1 Mail and Media, a subsidiary of United Internet, one of the world's largest web hosting and webmail companies. Hiding their identity as well as they legally can, United Internet, which operates free webmail solutions, web.de and gmx.net through subsidiaries, is apparently trying to trick millions of users into uninstalling certain Google Chrome and Mozilla Firefox extensions, the most famous of which are AdBlock Plus. Okay, I'm trying to think of the best way to explain this. It does so by leading users of its GMX and web.de webmail products to a website, browsershinehealth.info, or roughly translates to browsersecurity.info, via a yellow website bar, misleading them into believing they're visiting an innocent site that lets them configure their browser settings. The site is designed to look like a security settings page, and only a small grayed out in-print text at the bottom of the page shows the identity of the web publisher, which is 1on1 Mail and Media. The browser Searchlight Info website goes to great lengths to instill fear in users' minds. I'm probably saying that word wrong, but anybody who's really getting offended at my mispronunciation, I'm from Kentucky. I'm sorry.
I didn't know Kentucky was a disability.
Yes.
When it comes to speech, the southern states are a disability.
Yep.
We don't enunciate.
Oh, damn it, you did that on purpose, didn't you?
You might think that. The website goes into great lengths to instill fear in users' minds, tricking them into thinking their security is at risk for using browser add-ons that are merely designed to block advertisements, which of course is United Media's main income from free webmail products. Users are invited to learn how to restore security by disabling and removing the supposedly unsafe browser extensions, singling out AdBlock Plus products for filtering page content, AdGuard, Awesome New Tab Page, and a handful of others. So what's going on here is 1on1 owns some subsidiary companies, and a couple of them are free webmail providers, in Germany. And what they've done is they've put on their webmail products these security recommendations, which take you to this browsersecurity.info page, which tells you that running AdBlock and plugins like AdBlock are bad and a security risk, and that you should uninstall them.
Surprise, internet kiddos. Not everything you read on the internet is true.
What?
But what if I saw it on TV and the internet? Does it become true then? Because I'm basing my entire security parameters around Super Shield right now.
Yeah.
It's new technology. It whitelists things. I feel someone should slap me. That joke should not have happened.
I would, but that would require getting up, and I'd have to drive
getting
over
in the
there.
Car and driving there. And...
I guess somebody can beat me later. I don't know.
So, anyways, next story up. This one is from Fox10TV.com. City News Service reported that Tuesday's lawsuit in Los Angeles alleges invasion of privacy and identity theft. According to the suit, the woman took her cell phone to a Sprint location in Los Angeles last year to exchange it for a new model, but it did not erase her data because she wanted her phone numbers transferred to the new device. So she exchanged her phone. She didn't keep it. She gave it back to Sprint. The phone also contained some intimate photos of the couple that she had forgotten about. The woman claimed she was promised the phone would be wiped before it was refurbished, but an employee at a Sprint factory in Kentucky found the photos and posted two to her Facebook page. A message seeking comment from a Sprint spokesperson wasn't immediately returned.
What an easy way to get fired. Sprint employee at the factory posted the photos to her Facebook page. Wow.
Yeah. I call bullshit.
No, I think people are that stupid.
This is why you should wipe your phone before you take it anywhere where you're going to lose it. Like, if you're going to turn it into be recycled or whatever, delete everything.
How about not taking naked photos of yourself or anyone you're intimate with your fucking phone?
That's
get
another
a camera.
Really good point.
Fucking stupid.
I know. I don't
God
know why you would carry pictures around like that with you everywhere in your pocket, just hanging out there.
It's not my fault. It's the internet's fault.
It, you know, Hugo's got a good point going on in the IRC here that, you know, because this article is not very clear, I assume it was posted to the Sprint employees Facebook page, and then Facebook did the face tagging thing and then alerted, said, "Hey, you were just tagged in a photo. Go check it." Uh-huh. You almost, I kind of wonder if that's got to be what happened, because otherwise the face, you know, the Sprint employee would have had to look, figure out who they were, which if you have their phone may not be so bad, then post it on Facebook and say, "Hey, we've got this picture."
I'm thinking if Thunder Slut there is taking photos of herself, she's probably not the smartest fucking person. She's going to leave personal detail all over there, probably emails, fucking her accounts are probably all signed in as well.
That's a good point. Yeah, they could have posted it on her Facebook page as her if it still had her credentials on the phone.
Exactly.
Trusted device. Let's get into her bank account.
How many people don't sign out of shit on their phones?
I'm thinking I need to get a job at a phone repair store now. I tell you what, that's a...
I gotta stop sharing my...
So just, you know, if you gotta take your phone in to get it worked on, you know, or if you're sending it off to be exchanged or recycled or whatever, you ought to probably wipe it or at least go in and sign out of everything and maybe flip through your photos and make sure you don't have one of your balls in there. Just a thought.
Or Madman's ass.
It was the most convenient camera to take a picture of my ass with. I mean, who wanted to pull out a digital camera when you had your phone already ready? That one's for you, Big, in case you're listening. I've got some other selfies I can post to your phone or whatever car you're driving.
Oh, God.
That's a new one. I never thought about that. When you hop in those rental cars and it automatically syncs with your phone.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's why I don't have Bluetooth on my phone.
Yeah, normally if you're not using your Bluetooth, you want to turn it off.
Just think of how many stereos my ass could be on right now.
So many.
The answer is 6, because that's how many rental cars I've been in.
I'm really hoping somebody who works for that rental car company, you know, found the cached photo and went, "Oh my God!"
That's the way they were giving us the funny looks when we returned it.
All right. Next story up is from phys.org, phys.org. Now, Cycros actually sent me an alternative version of the story, but just from a different site, so I want to point that out. Researchers at the University of Liverpool have shown for the first time that Wi-Fi networks can be infected with a virus that can move through densely populated areas as effectively as the common cold spreads between humans. The team designed and simulated an attack by a virus called Chameleon and found that not only could it spread quickly between homes and businesses, but it was able to avoid detection and identify the points at which Wi-Fi access is least protected by encryption and passwords. Researchers at the university's School of Computer Science and Electrical Engineering and Electronics simulated an attack on Belfast and London as a laboratory setting and found that Chameleon behaved like an airborne virus, traveling across the Wi-Fi network via access points that connect households and businesses to Wi-Fi networks. Areas that were more densely populated have more APs in closer proximity to each other, which means that the virus propagated more quickly, particularly across networks connectable within a 10 to 50 meter radius. Alan Marshall, professor of network security at the university, said when Chameleon attacked an AP, it didn't affect how it worked, but it was able to collect and report the credentials of all other Wi-Fi users who connected to it. The virus then sought out other Wi-Fi APs that could connect to and infect. Chameleon was able to avoid detection as current virus detection systems look for viruses that are present on the internet or computers, but Chameleon is only ever present in the Wi-Fi network. Whilst many APs are sufficiently encrypted And paths were protected. The virus simply moved on to find those which weren't strongly protected, including open access Wi-Fi points common to locations such as coffee shops and airports. Professor Marshall continued, Wi-Fi connections are increasingly a target for computer hackers because of well-documented security vulnerabilities, which make it difficult to detect and defend against a virus. It was assumed, however, that it wasn't possible to develop a virus that could attack Wi-Fi networks, but we demonstrated that this is possible and that it can spread quickly. We are now able to use the data generated from this study to develop a new technique to identify when an attack is likely. So now what this thing's doing is it's not actually infecting and damaging computers. It's targeting access points. So it'll hop onto a computer or a cell phone or whatever, but it's just the data device is just a carrier. The access point is the actual target of the virus. So... and of course it's a new virus, so obviously your antivirus didn't do shit and it's not going to fit any of your current heuristics, but it's kind of interesting because of the way it's spread like an actual virus. Yeah,
computer viruses are becoming actual viruses.
So it's just interesting because they said it was spreading from AP to AP, especially when two APs could talk to each other, it could spread to the next one. But on ones it couldn't, it would get carried out via cell phones and laptops and stuff like that. So
I still don't understand what how is it living on the access point? Is it actually living on the AP itself?
It would have to be, wouldn't it?
I guess. That's story's confusing me. I don't understand what they mean really.
It's going for open access points, so I'm assuming it's going for the really dumb ones that are wide open with no, you know, like weak password set.
Right.
So it's probably sitting there doing like a quick brute force list, and you know, I don't know if they're modifying the currently installed firmware or they're replacing firmware, but if they're doing that, I would assume that would severely limit the scope of the attack.
Yeah, because you're only going to be able to work on certain APs if you're, and you would have to have some sort of backdoor in order to upload the new firmware to it.
Well, I don't know. Most APs have some pretty good backdoors in them, so that's not a big deal. It could also, a lot of access points, even though they're branded differently and run different firmwares, they're actually usually the same hardware or very similar. So I could see a firmware modification working.
Hmm.
Because they all have the same chipsets in them, basically. You know, a lot of them use the same SKUs of processor, the same SKUs of, you know, Broadcom chipset or whatever. I mean, I could see some kind of a firmware mod working across lots of different devices, but that'd still be something rough to make sure it gets exactly right, because otherwise you're going to be bricking things left and right.
Yeah, that's what, I don't know, this seems silly to me.
A semi-fatal transmittable computer virus.
Well, as long as it doesn't make the computer explode, you know, I mean, because viruses can apparently do that now, according to like all modern television.
I was just thinking, you're bricking random coffee houses and then spreading to other ones. This would be a fun script kiddie tool to break things with.
Yeah, well, that's for damn sure.
And that's the only thing I could see this possibly being used for, script kiddie stuff. Does
oh, it... no. I can think of a really good use for it.
If you're modifying firmware, can you also have it save stuff that's being hit by that Wi-Fi
I wouldn't
point?
Have it save it locally, but I mean... This, you know, can you imagine a botnet made up of your router?
Well, but you aren't going to have... Well, I mean, the processing power and memory on a most firm little router is home router.
Who cares?
It's nothing.
It's man in the middle, though. Who cares if it's got no processing power? You're looking for passwords and banking logins. Who the
okay,
fuck cares?
Okay, so you're doing packet captures at the gateway, then. Well, I don't know. It still seems silly to me because if it's only going to be working on access points that are completely open, that are inconfigured as it is, and
it's
obviously...
Well, that was for this test.
But think, once it gets on, let's say I take my laptop to Barnes & Noble, and Barnes & Noble's Wi-Fi point's infected. My laptop gets infected. I then go to American Bank & Trust and use an open Wi-Fi point there, then a Wi-Fi point at the bank is infected. Or even if it's not open, I take it to a friend's house, and my laptop has the Wi-Fi key to that person's router.
But it's still got to have the right type of firmware for that access point to be able to upload it, and it's got to have some sort of backdoor. Not all
Like
those
Morp
access points are
said,
going to be the same.
How many routers are just rebranded same parts?
Yeah, it is, but there's still so many out there. I don't think that's plausible.
There's a common backdoor in a lot of them right now. It's a high number TCP port that's open, and it started on Linksys, but they found it a ton of them. And
so let's say it only works on Linksys routers. How many people own a Linksys?
I've got one. I don't use it, but I've got one.
Write it for a brand that is popular or has a lot of sub-brands.
So, I mean, it's certainly got limited. It's not, you know, it's not like a Windows virus that can hit everything. But I could see it being big enough to be effective.
Yeah, we could cause real havoc with it.
Oh, Cycros is saying in the longer article that went into it, I see in the IRC now, he's saying he was only using default passwords. Ooh, apparently we just had an IRC split or something. That's annoying. So, now I'm in there twice. Whatever. So Cycros is saying they were only hitting once with the default passwords. So that's your backdoor. But there are backdoors in those things, man. Tons of
Yeah, I know that, but like I said, there's so many different firmwares out there, so many different models.
I know imagine they were probably targeting pretty specific ones.
Right,
but
that's the only way I can think of that this could work.
Yeah. Still, though. All right, last story up for tonight. This one's from Schneier's blog, Bruce Schneier's blog. Last October, he speculated that the best way to go about designing and implementing a software backdoor. He suggested three characteristics of a good backdoor: low chance of discoverability, high deniability if discovered, and minimal conspiracy to implement. The critical iOS vulnerability that Apple patched last week is an excellent example. Look at the code. What caused the vulnerability is a single line of code, a second go-to-fail statement. Since that statement isn't a conditional, it causes the whole procedure to terminate. The flaw is subtle, hard to spot when scanning the code. It's easy to imagine that this could have happened by error, and it would have been trivially easy for one person to add the vulnerability. Was this done on purpose? Well, Bruce Schneier has no idea. But if he wanted to do something like this on purpose, this is exactly how he would do it. And he edited it today to add, if the Apple auditing system is any good, they would be able to trace this errant go-to line to not just the source code check-in details, but to the specific login that made the change. And then they would quickly know whether it was just an error or deliberate change by a bad actor. And, of course, then he asks if anybody knows what's going on inside Apple. But in case anybody's not aware, iOS and OS X, actually, that the Apple implementation of SSL has had a bug in it for like a year that would essentially cause SSL to fail open. I'm trying to think how to explain it. When it's doing the TLS handshake, it falls back to the highest encryption that both devices support, and this bug was causing Apple devices to essentially say, we support clear text.
Wow. That's a
so,
problem.
Guess what? All your logins on an iPad and an iPhone since, for about a year are, sent out in clear text. So if you used your iPad to log into your bank at a public Wi-Fi terminal, you might want to change a password. And they're pushing out the patch slowly and only to supported operating systems. So, for example, Apple just recently announced they're not supporting Snow Leopard anymore, which means Snow Leopard isn't getting this fix.
Interesting.
Time to buy an upgraded operating system is what Apple is telling you.
Yeah, basically. They pushed the patch earlier, but apparently it hasn't gotten to everybody yet, too, because it's, of course, software patching, and they've had this bug for a while in both OS X and iOS. So let's go ahead and move into this. Where's soundboard? I've lost my soundboard. Okay, first up in Digital Dojo, and Sard beat me. He already posted there. See, he screwed me up there. It's like, damn it, he found what I was going to... Oh, no, he's pulling that from the show notes.
Yeah.
There is a website called gotofail.com. And what gotofail.com does, and Hugo saying that apps that handle their own SSL code are fine, he's right. They do. They are fine, but the operating system is still vulnerable. So if you go to this gotofail.com, it actually runs a quick test of the SSL implementation on your operating system to see if you're vulnerable to Apple's gotofail bug. And I tested this with a couple of devices I had access to at work and at home, and it works fine. And I haven't seen it do anything malicious, so I'm pretty sure the site's okay because it's not asking for any details. It just does a quick test to see if you've got the bug or not. But what it does is if your OS is clean, it just comes up, you're good. If you've got a device, like I took an OS X machine that had not been patched at work and went to go to fail. And I opened up Safari, and in bright red, you've got the bug. Don't log into anything. Upgrade your operating system immediately. My God, run for the hills, right? And then I opened up Firefox and went to it on the same machine. And it said, well, your browser's okay, but your operating system's not. You should, you know, be careful with your email and everything else. And patch as soon as possible. So, yeah. I tested it on an old iPad. Of course, it comes up, you know, God help you. And I tested it on an Android phone. Of course, it says you're fine. So, but and actually, my new iPad, it came up okay. So I'd already gotten the patch on my new iPad, but my old one, it was just kind of, it was. Of course, that one's all jailbroken and everything, so it's not going to patch anyways. But yeah, so don't do anything important with that iPad. Good to know. Well, because if you're running iOS 6, you've got the bug, and they're not going to fix it. You've got to upgrade to iOS 7 to fix it.
Interesting.
So, anyways, but it's still it's a good test to do. And then the next thing I have up is if you do a lot of network scanning, this is a fun tool. It's called the Eyewitness Triage Tool, and what this thing, just a slug from their website here, Eyewitness is designed to take a file, parse out the URLs, and then take screenshots of the web pages and generate a report of the screenshots along with some server header information. Eyewitness is able to parse three different types of files, a general text file with each URL on a new line, the XML output from an nmap scan, and that's the part that I find particularly useful, or a .nessus file. Jason Hill worked on creating the XML parsing code for Eyewitness and provided a lot of feedback throughout writing it. He also compared the results of both the XML and the Nessus parsing to Tim Tome's In Peeping Tom, which is, and they're near identical, so they're happy with the parsing capabilities. In addition to providing the file name, you also provide a maximum timeout value. The timeout value is the maximum amount of time Eyewitness waits for the web page to render before moving on to the next URL on the list. Couple of things Eyewitness does to differentiate itself. Eyewitness is able to identify web application default credentials for web pages that it is looking at. So when Eyewitness recognizes a web application, it throws the default credentials at it along with the server info. So it'll tell you if they haven't changed the password or not. So it's got a small number of web pages that it recognizes, but that's because they don't have a lot, so they're hoping to get that expanded out through open source. So anyways, I guess to explain this thing, if you've ever done a large amount of network testing, everything's got a web page to configure it these days. Almost every little embedded device, printer, router, whatever, you're going into a web application to set it up. And when almost everything is responding on port 80, it takes a long time to test them all. So it kind of helps to know where you want to start. So you throw your list at this tool, and it generates a report with a screenshot of every page and a little bit of server information. So you can take your nmap output of everything that responded with a web server, then have this tool go out and hit every web server on the network, take a screenshot, test a couple of default passwords and give you a report, which is really nice when it comes down to trying to find the servers you should be poking at and the ones that you don't care about.
Yeah, definitely. I could use this.
Oh, I use it already. It is so nice because I'll find something in a scan, spend a few minutes on it, and figure out, oh, fuck, it's a printer. You know? And it's like, it's not that printers are not useful, but they're most of the time for me, they're not in scope. So it's still a lot of fun. So,
right. That's cool.
And that is a quick way to take a ton of screenshots of web pages. So anyways, though, that's really all we've got. That's all I've got for tonight. Listen to the stream. I'm going to be working on it this weekend. Hopefully we'll be back up and running 100% here in the next couple of weeks. Pure Decking every Thursday. Shoot the Noise on Wednesdays. Is Shoot the Noise coming back, or is that kind of on permanent hiatus? What's the...
It's on hiatus at the moment.
Yeah.
We're working on I Have Nothing This Weekend, I think. Maybe a show.
Okay.
Maybe.
Okay, cool. Cool. Missing Dialogues on Tuesdays, the Galaxy 15 radio site, the Twitter handle, the feedback form, and the subreddit. So that's, and we still accept TCP/IP via carrier pigeon. You're going to want to send that carrier pigeon care of Big Brother. And so.
Warning, you don't get pigeon back.
Well, he's got to eat something. I mean,
I know.
And he's just a stick. I mean, he doesn't.
Uses the feather oils for his beard.
Wow. Anyways, that's all I've got. Did I miss anything on promotions? No, you covered IHN. That's all the shows. Let's Get Drunk. I don't know when the next Let's Get Drunk is because we kind of missed a couple because of the stream issues, so I don't know what's going on with that. But I'm going to hit play on this music unless anybody else has anything real quick.
Nope.
Break me, rebuild my soul. This body has got to go. Replace all of my fractured bones. I want to live, I want to know. Where was God when I was born? The day that I was torn from the womb. Sterile room, I'm baptized and looking at you. I've heard you heathen shout to throw the science out. What to do when the world breaks you? Give up the lie and we'll fix you too. Upgrade me deeper, biological creature. Upgrade me deeper, my body's my machinery. Upgrade me deeper, biological creature. Upgrade me deeper, my body's my machinery. Analyze my discontents, debug and now repent. How can steel have a soul? My spirit is electrical. I found a cure for death, an exploit in my breath. I traded soul the body parts with cruise control. Upgrade me deeper, biological creature. Upgrade me deeper, my body's my machinery. Upgrade me deeper, biological creature. Upgrade me deeper, my body's my machinery. Of the death devil. creature. Upgrade me deeper. My body's my machinery. Upgrade me deeper. Biological creature. Upgrade me deeper. My body's my machinery. Upgrade me deeper. Biological creature. Upgrade me deeper. My body's my machinery. Upgrade me deeper. Biological creature. Upgrade me deeper. My body's my machinery. 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 My body's my machinery.